From WVUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In a little over 10 years, cars in the United States will have to meet new, aggressive fuel efficiency standards. With that push for a cleaner, smarter car, the auto industry is being revolutionized. Gasoline is on the decline. Electronic and hydrogen fuel cells are on the way up. New light materials are being used in the body of the car, and computers are being added, from advanced GPS to vehicle-to-vehicle communications that makes self-driving closer than ever. This hour on Point, the future of the car. Joining me today are two editors from Car and Driver magazine who oversaw their current big feature on the future of the car, Battleground 2025. Eddie Alterman, editor-in-chief at Car and Driver magazine. Eddie, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks, Jane.
And from Ann Arbor, Michigan, Eric Tingwall, technical editor of Car and Driver. Eric, nice to have you as well.
Thanks for having me, Jane.
So, Eddie, let's start with you. It sounds like the car of the future will look a whole lot different from what we're driving right now. We'll get into all the details, but give us a headline description of the car of the future.
Well, it's all being driven by this push to radically overhaul fuel economy. Basically, between now and 2025, or between the 2010 standard and 25, fuel economy for cars will essentially have to double. And same for trucks. Now, it's a kind of complex formulation of size and fuel economy. But as we sit here right now, there are only three vehicles that make the grade for 2025, the Toyota Prius C, the Toyota Prius, and the Honda Accord Hybrid. And no trucks make the 2025 standard. And the 2025 standard is 54.5 MPG combined between cars and trucks, which corresponds roughly to about 47 MPG on your window sticker.
So with these new fuel efficiency standards then, Eric, where is this push for cleaner cars coming from? Is it consumers? Is it lawmakers?
Well, this is entirely being driven by legislation. So the CAFE program, which stands for Corporate Average Fuel Economy, is administered by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. And so they're the ones who put that 54.5 MPG number out there. Obviously, fuel economy is a shopping point. It's a reason people buy cars. They choose a certain car over another car. But really, these big, drastic changes are being driven by the government.
And so to get there, to get to these numbers, what are the biggest innovations in the auto industry right now? What are you seeing? Eddie?
Well, I think there are three parts of it. There's the legislative policy that Eric talked about, and that's really the spearhead. The tip of the spear is really California with the California Air Resources Board that is pushing for really a pretty aggressive gas-free future. Then the second piece of it is the technology. How are we going to get these cars to that number? And it's going to have to happen through alternative propulsion technologies, and that includes the trusty old internal combustion engine, but it also has to do with lightweight materials and even to some extent, social apps like car sharing apps. And then that sort of feeds into the third point, which is the social cultural aspect of all of this. And will people give up their big V8 engines for smaller engines? And we're seeing that happen. We're seeing the adoption rates really quite high because, people don't have much choice. And, the new Ford Mustang, really, really sexy car. One of the premium engines is a four-cylinder. Mustang is totally, associated with big gas-swilling V8s. But it's not the case anymore.
Eric, you write that anyone who believes that battery electric or hydrogen fuel cell vehicles don't have a future greatly underestimates the bullheadedness of Californians. Tell us what California, to Eddie's point, has done to affect a major automotive and cultural shift when it comes to these new automotive technologies.
Yeah, well, it goes all the way back to the Clean Air Act back in 1970. And that was when the national government enacted these environmental regulations. But California already had its own on the books. And so California is the single state in the country that is permitted to make its own regulations for greenhouse gas control. And other states are allowed to adopt California's standards, but California is really the only one that can go beyond what the national government has set. And so while the federal government has established this 54.5 mile per gallon target that we're headed toward, California is really pushing zero emission vehicles. And those are battery electric vehicles or fuel cell hydrogen vehicles. And by establishing these standards that automakers must sell a certain percentage of their California vehicle sales as zero emission vehicles, they have actually created this market of Nissan Leafs, Tesla Model S, Chevy Spark EV, and we're now starting to see a few hydrogen vehicles that will be offered in small quantities in Southern California only.
Hmm. So the fuel cell vehicle seems to be, from my understanding, the sort of the holy grail of the automotive industry, right? It promises the low emissions of a battery electric vehicle with the range and the refueling convenience of a gas-powered car, right? Tell us how fuel cell vehicles work.
Well, a fuel cell vehicle is fueled up with gaseous hydrogen. So you pull up to a pump, it looks very much like a normal gas pump you might see today, but there is a slightly more complex fitting so that gas isn't going to leak out as you're connected with the car. It's going to take about 10 or 15 minutes to fill that tank with high-pressure hydrogen, and you're going to disconnect and you're going to drive off. Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, the advantage here is zero tailpipe emissions. In terms of carbon dioxide or greenhouse gases, you do get water coming out of the tailpipe or water vapor. And, that's the dream, I guess.
Is it a dream, Eddie, or how close are we to getting there?
Well, it's sort of hard to put the cart before the horse. And one of the things that is so difficult and challenging about any vehicle program is these cars take a long time to produce. So
how long generally?
Well, 7 years in the planning, 7 to 3 years in the planning. And the difficulty there is you can't really put an engine in the car that doesn't exist yet. You can't put a motor in the car that doesn't exist. You can't plan, you can't see in the future that far to say, okay, fuel cell will have an infrastructure. It will be a mature technology by the time this car goes on sale. That's a billion-dollar bet that most car makers are not willing to make. So you go with, accepted, proven technologies like the internal combustion engine, like battery electric vehicles. But, there is this great tension. I think that that's what the feature that Eric put together really shows, is that there are these wars between these technologies. Yes, fuel cell is the holy grail. The manufacturers want it because when you get to scale, the parts costs come down radically and there are zero emissions. But there are other problems. Like if you have a home hydrogen fueling station, for example, you probably want to put that on top of your garage because we've all seen those pictures of the Hindenburg. I mean, there are issues related to all this stuff, and none of it is going to be easy. So the prime movers, the batteries and internal combustions, really have an advantage in this, and we're seeing some people exploit those spaces in the market really, really effectively. Elon Musk, for example. He's done an incredible job of that.
Mm-hmm. Talk about Elon Musk a little bit. How has Tesla and Elon Musk changed the industry?
Well, he saw that there was a need for people to feel both good about being green and also wanting to flaunt their wealth. And, prior to that point, the Prius or maybe the Volt was really the only way you could do that. But those were, $20,000, $40,000 cars. They really didn't say, hey, I'm rich and I care about the environment the way the Tesla Model S does. So it's this perfect kind of, Venn diagram of rich eco guy represented by that car. But he, again, has that advantage. He didn't have to – he started from scratch in a way. And he also has this, I think, brilliant, brilliant model for the car that Detroit doesn't have. He's really got a Silicon Valley business model. And, he's going to build the coolest thing he can build. He's going to get everybody excited about it. It's going to do things that General Motors, Toyota, Mercedes-Benz can't do. He's going to make everybody look like an idiot. And then, you know, so he's going to lose $50,000 on every car because the batteries are so expensive. I don't think he really cares. I think he's going to cross that bridge when he comes to it. And, you know, he's already building these things in Toyota's plant in Fremont, California. I think one day Toyota's going to say, hey, thanks for keeping our plant warm. Here's billions of dollars. Now, please go away. And, you know, we'll see what happens there. But he's such an amazing disruptive force. And every time we think he can't do it, he does it. He's just – it's very cool to watch.
Well, I want to talk about the accessibility of some of these cars, to your point about the cost of them and the wealthy sort of flaunting what they've got. But what about the rest of us? Let's get to that after the break. Eddie Alterman is editor-in-chief at Car and Driver magazine and Eric Tingwall, technical editor at Car and Driver. We're talking about the future of the car. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. Play some sound here. This is earlier in the month. Elon Musk, chief executive of Tesla Motors, took Betty Liu, a reporter for Bloomberg, on a test drive of the new Tesla Model P85D. He showed off Tesla's autopilot feature.
So it's on full autopilot right now. Oh, I'm not okay. Touching anything. No hands, no feet, nothing.
What technology is in here?
It's a combination of radar, camera with image recognition, and ultrasonic sensors. That's integrated with maps and real-time traffic. Mm-hmm. And it's really what enables autopilot capabilities, the synthesis of all those four systems.
So is this what an autonomous car is? Is this an autonomous car? Is that what he's talking about, Eddie?
Yeah, they're on the road already. Mm. You know, all these technologies are front-loaded into the cars. Your backup camera in your Nissan Altima, your forward-facing radar, all these things enable hands-free driving. In fact, the Mercedes-Benz S-Class, we were driving it last summer, and it will allow you to go around the corner with your hands off the wheel. And there's even a hack to get the thing to drive by itself all the time. You put a Coke can, you Velcro a Coke can to the wheel, and the thing will just go. And the cynical part of me says, this is all an elaborate way to allow people to text while driving.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if cars were less boring, people wouldn't want them to drive themselves. But the point is, the technology is here. It's the legislative issues, the social issues. I think, you know, we'll accept one person crashing into another person. We will not accept two computers doing it. That's just way too scary. And at the same time, I don't think that the car makers want to assume all that liability. So there are a lot of issues here beyond the technology.
I actually rode in an autonomous car prototype at Google in California last year. And I have to tell you, it was quite unnerving. Maybe I'm just not used to it, but unnerving is the word that comes to mind. What's the public reaction to these cars, Eric?
Well, there have been studies done, and one of the funny things is they ask, if cars could drive themselves, what would you do? And a huge number of people, more than 50%, say they would watch the road. And, you know, I believe that would happen for maybe the first 20 miles, and then people
right.
are going to text
right.
and,
right.
you know, browse Twitter and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, I think people are ready for it in the sense that they understand the technology is there because it very much is. This is something that could totally happen today, right? Google has the demonstration cars.
Yep.
It's just a matter of automakers figuring out the business plan, the liability, and the pricing. Who's
well, that's
pay for
right.
it.
The cost. And what is the cost? What's the average cost of one of these cars?
Well, if you look at the Mercedes-Benz S-Class, which has probably the closest thing to an autonomous car on the road today, which lets you go hands-free for about 16 seconds, and then it starts beeping at you to put your hands back on the steering wheel. That's a $150,000 car right there.
Right, right.
So, you know, we're not going to see this on $20,000 cars anytime soon.
Anytime soon? So bringing down the cost to make these cars accessible to a general population is probably not going to happen for what, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years?
I would say at least 20.
Hmm.
Yeah, and full autonomy, I think, if it does happen, is probably 20 years away. I think there are blended solutions, though. Vehicle-to-vehicle communication, which is being worked on by the U of M Transportation Research Institute, which is right in Car and Driver's backyard in Ann Arbor. They're working on vehicle-to-vehicle communication where cars tell each other that they're approaching red lights, and that could help safety quite a bit. Mm. There are vehicle-to-infrastructure advances that they're working on where the lights will be timed to allow cars to go. And I think that, you know, automotive safety has taken such incredible strides in the past 20 years, and it's only going to get better. And, I think one of the themes that emerged when we were doing the research for this story is, you know, when car makers tell you they can't do something or something can't be done, they're always going to go ahead and do it. It took a very, very long time after the first fuel crisis in the early 70s for cars to really become fun to drive again and to be enjoyable and to have great efficiency. It took almost until the Mercedes-Benz 300E of 1986 to get all that low-friction stuff in there and actually have an enjoyable car at the same time. This switch has happened so much more quickly. And
yes,
I think a lot of that
yes.
is because of data modeling and things. We just have more computing power.
Right. Let's get a caller in here. Alex in Coral Springs, Florida. Hi, Alex. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to On Point.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
So I have two questions, and I'll gladly take them off the air. Recently, I purchased a car. I drove both the Prius and the Volt. And my concern was that no matter how much I calculated, it doesn't seem to make sense currently to buy this car in fuel savings. By the time you reach a break-even point, you pretty much have to get rid of the car. So it almost makes sense to get a non-hybrid. And why is the government here not doing what Norway did with respect to the Tesla model? And my second question, being a gearhead, and by the way, I actually just read your magazine yesterday for some research I was doing. Great articles. What happens to people like myself who really enjoy the analog experience of, you know, the visceral drive, the moving things, the being part of the car? Because I found, for example, the Prius, I was kind of disconnected from the drive. And I'll take my answers off the air. Thank you.
Alex, thank you very much. Eddie Alterman, go ahead.
Well, I'll take the second one first. My advice to you is to buy an old Porsche and just enjoy that while you still can. Eric, I don't know. Do you want to take the first part of that?
Yeah. As far as the economics, you know, if you're going to spend an extra $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 on a hybrid car that gets 50-plus miles per gallon, when is that going to pay off? Most calculations for something like a Prius or a Chevy Volt are going to show somewhere in the 80,000-mile range is when the upfront premium starts to be paid back on the amount you saved on gasoline. And as the caller said, you know, that's for a lot of people about the time you're getting rid of your car and you might be looking at something new. So it's a great point, and it's something that the government has to be cognizant of as they implement these 54.5-mile-per-gallon targets. If we move too fast, the technology might be there to implement this into cars, and we might be able to technically achieve it. But at the same time, we've priced cars out of reach for most people.
Right.
And cars stay on the road longer. They're spewing more pollutants to the air rather than people being able to update to a newer, more efficient model.
Hmm. Let me bring another voice into the conversation here. Joining me now from Cambridge, Massachusetts, is Robin Chase. She was co-founder and former CEO of Zipcar. She's now the founder and CEO of Buzzcar, a service that allows peer-to-peer car rentals, currently in France. Robin Chase, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
So when you started Zipcar those years ago and now with Buzzcar, what's your vision for the future of transportation?
Well, we know that people are going to be moving more and more into cities, and people in cities really don't want to own a car. They just want to use one when they need one. If you don't need a car to get to work, you definitely, as the previous caller was talking about, the finances of car ownership, if you don't need a car to get to work, you definitely don't want to own one because you'll be losing a lot of money.
So car sharing, is it a workable alternative for millennials who live in the city? What about when you get into the suburbs? What about when you got to drive the kids to soccer? I mean, there are a lot of logistical issues here that still need to be worked out.
Car sharing is appropriate for anyone who doesn't need a car to get to work. I know that Zipcar members, when I was doing it, were represented in their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. We saw definitely across the board, and definitely not all millennials. I'd say the majority of users are not millennials. They're overrepresented in that, you know, 20 to 35 group, but they're not the majority of members. I will say that if you have children, we found that when people have their second child, they do switch to car ownership, and then when their children have grown up, they come back. And actually, I was talking to people in New York City. Those drivers, those families continue to use Zipcar and shared car services.
So in the future, do you see the car as more of a service and not a product?
Today, it is a service instead of a product in cities around the world, and the percentage of car sharing is growing dramatically in cities around the world. Every car manufacturer knows that that's the challenge. And as I say, in cities, I think you will see private car ownership almost disappearing in the next 25 years. I would definitely.
So beyond that, what's the next step in car sharing, Robin Chase?
We're seeing a lot of different things. I mean, the future of transportation is multimodal, so we're seeing lots of things fit into that model. The amount of time that we spend driving versus using some other way to get to where we want to go is diminishing. So in the car portion of our trips, we're seeing, you know, one-way car rental, people driving us around. And as you've been discussing, I think the autonomous vehicle is coming much faster than anyone thinks, and that's going to dramatically change the future of transportation in general.
So in 25 years, what will you be driving, Robin?
In 25 years, I will probably be walking most places, biking most places, and when I need a car, it'll be an autonomous vehicle going door to door and hopefully shared.
Sounds like my nightmare.
You clearly don't live in the city. That's all I
know. I know. Well, I think Robin, first of all, thank you for being in the magazine. And Zipcar is such an amazing, amazing thing. But I do think it's an urban phenomenon.
It is an urban phenomenon, absolutely.
And there is a big, you know, trend toward reurbanization. Listen, we're in Detroit, and we're seeing the rebirth of that city, and we're seeing no vacancy rates in the new lofts downtown, and that's a great, great thing. But, you know, as a father of young children, I have to drive to work. This just wouldn't work for me.
I think you're right that for rural America, they're going to have incredible challenges ahead, but the bulk of America will be urbanized. And when we go to this autonomous vehicles, just imagine you're going to be putting your kids are going to be driven the car. If they need to drive to school, they'll be going by autonomous vehicle. So women right now spend way more time than anybody else driving kids around. Their lives are as chauffeurs, and this will dramatically improve their lives.
Let's get Mike in here from Spencer, West Virginia. Hi, Mike. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Honored to be with you.
Well, thank you for calling.
I'd like to speak for the general blue-collar, middle-class people that don't have a lot of money to work with, and in that there is an affordable, highly affordable, all-electric drive car that's available right now. I own it. As soon as I heard that the smart electric drive was making it available, I put money down, and I've got it parked in front of my house.
And what do you think? How's it working for you?
It is absolutely incredible. They claim 122 equivalent mile per gallon. It's twice as efficient as my little 250 motorcycle. I have two outlets outside the house. They're both 110. Just plug it into 110, charge it overnight. If I can charge during the day, I have a solar outlet that if I have a chance that I have sun, not very often, that I can get some solar charge. But even without solar charge, you just grid charge it at night, 110 regular plug, and this is a highly affordable car that anybody can drive if they drive less than 70 miles per day.
All right, Mike, thank you. Good luck to you. I appreciate you calling. Eric Tingwall, you know, we, in self-disclosure, we have a Volt. And I'm curious, generally, how electric bills are impacted by these electric cars.
Yeah, so if you look at a single charge on one of these cars, let's say something more than a volt. A volt might do 30 miles on a charge or up to 40.
Mm-hmm.
But one of these full electric cars, you're looking at, let's say, 80 miles, maybe 70. Something like that's going to cost you a couple dollars at most to go 70 miles. So you think in a car that would cost you maybe $10 worth of gas, $15 worth of gas, it will be maybe $3 in an electric car.
Robin, how do you see the future of autonomous vehicles?
So autonomous vehicles that are fully autonomous, not the ones that are coming along that do certain things. I see it as a really exciting future or a kind of horrifying future. What I learned profoundly when I was doing Zipcar, and I think probably everyone listening to this will relate to, is when we get into our car, we think that the cost of that trip is just gas. And so we kind of make our calculation, you know, do I want to go to this place? Oh, it's just, you know, the cost of the gas. What changes when you have an autonomous car is now you're going to make these calculations. I teed this up wrong. When I go someplace, it's the cost of the gas plus me driving. With an autonomous car, I don't even have to be in the car to run the errand, and so it really is just the cost of gas. And today we have 80% of the cars on the road are driven by one person alone in the car.
Mm-hmm.
I see the future of autonomous cars where I don't even have to be there, that we'll see, you know, 50% of the cars on the road will be empty. And that is going to be nightmarish because the congestion we have to cause today is because people are driving around by themselves in a big car, and we'll be adding to that mix a lot of empty cars driving around. And just to be more specific about that, think about us here in Boston. If I were to go someplace that had expensive parking downtown, instead of parking that car, I would say, oh, drive back home, park where I can park for free, and then come pick me up. And those would be totally new trips that would never have been done before. Or if I'm in a meeting, I will say, come get me, you know, at 10:15. Oh, you know what? I'm not ready till 10:30. Just keep circling the block until I'm ready. And all of that costs me basically nothing, just the cost of gas. So I see the autonomous vehicles as really having this potential for a nightmarish addition of empty vehicles all the time, everywhere. On the flip side, if all of those autonomous vehicles were shared cars and we were paying for each and every trip, which is what happens with Zipcar, people are very, very conscientious about when they actually want to use a car. And so they use a car when the car is the right thing. And I think we'll see autonomous vehicles, if I'm going to share the seats in that car, will be the price of public transit. And so now I'll have door-to-door public transit, which is what everyone has been wanting to have. You know, for $2.50, where do you want to go?
A lot to think about in the future. Robin Chase, I know I got to let you go here. Appreciate your time. Co-founder and former CEO of Zipcar. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the future of the car. Let's go to the phones again. David is calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Hi, David. Thanks for waiting. Welcome.
Hi, Jane and Eric and Eddie. I'm David Cash. I'm actually the commissioner in the state's Department of Environmental Protection. And fascinating show, great topic, so timely. And there is one perspective I think that maybe could add to the conversation, and that is the role that states and even cities and towns can play. Governor Patrick here has been a champion of clean and advanced vehicles. He has required our environment agency to work hand-in-hand with our Department of Energy Resources, which has been a real leader on this nationwide. And we've pulled together programs to solve the chicken and egg problem, right? People are going to be nervous to have an EV, an electric vehicle, if there's no place to charge it. So we've been putting out rebates both for consumers to $2,500 rebates for electric vehicles. And then we have a very robust infrastructure grant program for fleets, municipal and city fleets, and for companies as well, for places like Massport. You could find these places at parking lots at Logan Airport, for example. We've joined with 7 other states and committed in a zero emission vehicle action plan to get 300,000 electric vehicles on the road by 2025. And the callers that have raised concerns about sacrificing either quality or what the cost might be, is those rebates, both state and federal, are bringing the prices down. bring the prices down. So the payback period is much shorter, 3, 4, 5 years, and we see big win, a win-win-win situation. Mm. Cost savings for customers, cleaner air, and it's driving the innovation economy. We have companies here developing batteries, developing smart cars, new business models. I mean, Zipcar started here in the Northeast and in Massachusetts. Yep. So, you know, there's huge wins moving forward. And I guess we are talking about the vision. It's really connected with our whole electric grid as well. The vision that we have is that sometime in the future, your car is plugged in at night. There's a chip in it that says when electricity is cheap, fill up my car. And there's lots of offshore wind making cheap electricity. Your car fills up. You drive it to work. You plug it in. That same chip says sell back electricity when the price goes up. And on a hot summer day, you can imagine in Boston that instead of needing a new electric generator, you've got 50,000 or 100,000 cars that are all putting electricity back on the grid.
Oh, these are great points, David. And they require, really, Eric and Eddie, some different thinking about infrastructure.
Well, yeah.
Infrastructure, right?
I think David makes, you know, in a roundabout sort of way, the point that the government is intruding here. And the government has its thumb on the scale to some extent, and they're incentivizing EVs. Is that the right thing to do? I'm not sure. In Europe, diesel fuel is incentivized. And in many ways, diesel makes more sense for our long-range driving, our instantaneous torque is common to both electric vehicles and diesels, but it does suit our way of driving a little bit more with greater range. And here we're incentivizing EVs. Mm. And that has always seemed a little bit backward to me. And the reason for that is, and I know the grid is evolving to David's point, but half the cars, if you think about it, half the EVs are actually coal-powered cars because half of our grid is coal. And that will change, but it's not changed yet or fast enough.
You know, as David was talking, I appreciate your call, David. I was thinking of the Better Place model. I remember interviewing Shai Agassi over in Israel. He was sure that this was the future there. It didn't quite work out that way, did it, with the fueling stations that were all built? And I guess the question is, how can we be so sure that we'll be off and running with these charging stations and with all this new technology? It didn't work so well over there.
Yeah, you can't really predict the future. You can only try to make it. And we get back to Elon Musk, who is a big, big figure in all of this. And I'm sure you've heard about his Gigafactory outside of Reno, Nevada.
Yes, in Nevada, yeah. 10 million square feet, yeah.
Yeah. And so what he's trying to do is he's placing a big bet on batteries versus fuel cell. And he's trying to come up with a battery that has greater storage density at a cheaper price so that it will be adopted by more and more manufacturers, and Tesla will be leading the charge. He doesn't want it to go to fuel cell because he hasn't invested in fuel cell. Mm. And every time he says he's going to do something, he kind of does it.
Back to the phones. Michelle is in Chelmsford, Massachusetts. Hi, Michelle. Glad you waited. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Jane. I had a question. You know, I have teenagers, and I have one who actually plays in the orchestra playing the big string bass. So I drive a mommy minivan. I have no choice in that matter. Even if I wanted something else, I need a minimum of about 5.5 feet of cargo space.
Yes.
And then I throw in teenagers and whatever else, and we use it for my family. So it seems, and, you know, I drop off my kids in the morning, half the parking lot's minivans. Why aren't we seeing hybrids or, you know, EV minivans or, you know, some version of that where, you know, most of the soccer moms would love to be driving something more ecologically responsible than 18 to 23 miles to the gallon.
Excellent. Michelle, I'm so glad you called. Thank you. Eric Tingwall, you want to take that?
Yeah, I would love to. That's a great question and a great point she brings up, in that if we're improving a car from 30 to 35 miles per gallon, that does not reduce emissions as much as improving a minivan from 20 to 25 miles per gallon. So it's the same 5 mile per gallon increase, but percentage-wise, it's a bigger percentage from 20 to 25 miles per gallon. And that reduces our overall greenhouse gas emissions. Great way to reduce the overall effect of the vehicle fleet in the United States. One reason automakers haven't moved that way is because does increasing adding 3 or 4 miles per gallon to something that doesn't get very good fuel economy? Does it really increase its attractiveness to consumers? And GM tried this with full-size trucks. They had a hybrid system, didn't sell very well. They no longer offer that. Chrysler is saying it will have a plug-in hybrid minivan in the next couple years. I would predict something like that might do 10 miles of electric range, and then the gas engine would kick in, and you would see maybe 30 miles per gallon in a best-case scenario.
And would the cost be about what we're paying now for those minivans?
I would expect there to be, you know, a $5,000 premium on that compared to current minivans.
What about lightweighting as far as innovations are concerned? I know this is an important piece of it. What is lightweighting? Eric?
Well, this is the other...
Eddie, go ahead. Go ahead.
This is the other lever you can pull. You can change the propulsion system, or you can make the car lighter. And aluminum is now coming on very, very strong. The Ford F-150, which is 31% of Ford's sales, it's really its own car company unto itself. This is the best-selling vehicle. This pickup truck is the best-selling vehicle in America. It's going to an all-aluminum body. It'll still have some steel in the frame, but it is an aluminum beast. And Ford is making a big bet that they're going to get great fuel economy from just lightening it up. And, Eric, I know that you just weighed – you just drove the F-150.
How was it, Eric?
Yeah, we just drove the new F-150. I have to say, from behind the wheel, you probably would have no idea that it's made from aluminum rather than a steel body. Ford is claiming up to 700 pounds of weight reduction, which is a massive amount of weight to take out of a car. We put one on the scales and saw that it was closer to 520 pounds on that particular configuration, which is still quite a feat. And the one thing, as Eddie was saying, this is the most popular vehicle in America. So if Ford can scale up this aluminum technology and the manufacturing of aluminum body panels and assembling them into a car body, that will have huge implications for the rest of the industry, allowing us to do this for cheaper and cheaper vehicles.
So interesting. Here's Aubrey in Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Aubrey. Welcome to On Point.
Well, thank you. Yeah, Nashville on my way to Birmingham.
Okay.
I've been selling cars and trucks, fleet, retail, commercial, for 20 years. Ford, Chevy, Dodge, Mercedes, Lexus, mostly Chevy. You know, I got to say, most of this stuff, you know, I'll talk about, it's all market driven. You know, the idea of an autonomous car. I mean, think about the NRA and their guns. When you start taking the freedom away from somebody to drive their own car, because you can't have it both. It's either going to be autonomous or it's not. And, you know, because you can't have people driving, turning the steering wheel and then a computer, you know, in the car next to you driving it.
All right, Aubrey, I got it. Thank you very much for calling. One perspective for sure. Brad is in Charleston, South Carolina. Hi, Brad. Go ahead. You're on.
Hi, I was calling also about the automatronic cars.
Okay.
Would that possibly increase the rate of intoxicated drivers behind the wheel? Just, you know, having too many out of the bar one night and calling your car and say, hey, drive me home, I can't drive?
That's another point. We talked about texting, but Brad wonders about some of these other more practical issues. Eric or Eddie?
Well, one thing that would be great about truly autonomous cars that can take you door to door with no driver intervention would be the fact that we would hopefully take drunk drivers off the road, right? There would be no reason to get in your car and drive if your car can drive you home. Now, realistically, that's a long ways off, right? And the more likely scenario is cars that are partially autonomous. And like this Mercedes lets you go 16 seconds without touching the steering wheel. And in that case, yeah, people could be lulled into a very false sense of security that they can make it home because the car is doing 80% of the driving, but you really need a driver the other 20% of the time. And one thing I think we'll see in California, Google had some demonstration cars, right, demonstrating their autonomous technology that they wanted to remove the steering wheel and the pedals. So basically it had a way to input a destination, a start button, and an emergency stop button. And the California government there said that's not going to fly. You have to have controls in this car for a human to take over in case something goes wrong. And I see that being the standard for the entire country for a long time to come. So even if there's the technology out there that allows you to go door to door without having user intervention, the controls are still going to be right in front of the driver. And in that sense, you probably don't want somebody who's intoxicated getting behind the wheel and then at some point later in the drive grabbing control of the car.
And Jane, I think to Eric's point, like all of these technologies that we're talking about, they will be blended. It's the hybrid model. And the hybrid spectrum ranges from, you know, pure electric or fuel cell vehicles on one end to internal combustion on the other. And the Prius was the first step toward the pure electric, and the Volt was another step, and the Tesla Model S is a pure electric. I think that's how these technologies embed. And Eric is, I think, right. And it's hard to predict the future, but it seems most plausible that there will not be a desire on the part of the manufacturers or the drivers to take those controls away. It's just too much too soon.
What about this new technology that detects health crises behind the wheel, even senses if you're having a heart attack? Eric?
Yeah. So this is a Ford technology that was recently in the news. They developed a seat with some sensors in it that can detect your heartbeat. And from that, you can sense if the driver's having a heart attack. And, you know, the logical next steps would be the ability to maybe pull the car to the side of the road and apply the brakes and use your cell phone connection to contact emergency services. Ford is saying this could maybe be in play by 2020. Now, Volvo did something kind of similar a couple years back, and they had a heartbeat sensor in the car. And originally it was billed as something that could detect if you left a child or a pet inside the car, which probably has a pretty broad appeal. But the sensors actually proved not to be sensitive enough to detect a small child's heartbeat. And so when it was implemented into the cars, it was billed as an intruder detection system. And as you approached your car on your key fob, you could hit a button, and if there was a heartbeat in the car, it would flash at you. And the idea was here, somebody was lurking in the back seat of your car. And, you know, that really is something that doesn't appeal to a lot of people when they have to pay for that feature, because it just doesn't come true in reality all that often. So you have to think about this heartbeat and heart attack detector in that way. At the end of the day, people are going to pay for this. And while it might happen a couple hundred times a year on the road that somebody has a severe medical emergency behind the wheel, I'm not sure many people are going to pay a couple hundred dollars to have that feature in their car.
But what if they have an auto nurse feature in the car? I'd pay for that.
Well, that sort of leads me to my last question here in our final minute. What will be your favorite innovation, your favorite feature, knowing everything that you know after writing this big piece in Car and Driver magazine? What will be your favorite feature in a car of the future? Eric, do you want to start?
Yeah, this is probably kind of boring, but for me, I'm excited about the lightweight technologies because as an enthusiast, a lightweight technology benefits me as much as it benefits the entire fleet in reducing overall emissions. So a lighter car handles better, it's more exciting to drive through corners, accelerates quicker, and it benefits fuel economy.
Eddie.
I absolutely agree with Eric. I'm very excited to get into a carbon fiber vehicle such as BMW is starting to make right now. And cars are just too heavy. All the safety stuff, all the electronics, it's, you know, we're combating it with better fuel economy from the engines, but I really like 2,500-pound cars.
Will the car set the temperature for me when I get in the morning? Will it already be warm
sure.
in these cold Boston winter days?
Yeah, you can set it to do that.
Well, thank you very much. What a terrific hour. Very interesting. Eddie Alterman, editor-in-chief at Car and Driver magazine. Really appreciate your time, Eddie. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Jane.
And Eric Tingwall, technical editor at Car and Driver. Eric, thanks to you as well.
Thanks for having us.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook. On Point is produced by Nick Anderson, Catherine Brewer, Abigail Collins, Julie Jopp, Sam Gil Rosen, Eileen Amata, Stefano Casonis, Hillary McQuilkin, Sarah Platt, James Ross, and Dean Russell. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.